Episode 106 of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. We have Stuart back talking about his experience at the Australian Open. But first, we get into a couple of clubland stories that we need to catch up on.
So whether you're in your car or going for a walk, enjoy this episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast.
Stuart's one of our highest ranked working rules officials that we have. One of the best we've got. He knows his stuff.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Golf Rules Questions podcast. This is number 106 and you're here with Blakey and Podcast McPhee.
Hello Blakey.
Welcome back after your long journey of refereeing over the last month or so.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yeah, how does it feel now that you're world famous?
That's been... No, I don't know about world famous. That's good. I'm really enjoying it.
Wow. Yeah.
I'm just enjoying being on course and...
And on TV.
Yeah, no. Enjoying being on course and applying what we talk about all the time and learning about this stuff and applying for real and helping players. I think it's the best bit of the job.
Well, just helping. When I was mentoring you or presenting with Brian, the first level two that you went to, we were going through the art of refereeing, and one of the first slides had why you get into refereeing, and there was a dot point there to get yourself on TV, and I saw your face light up, and I, you know, it was just at that moment that a light bulb just came on. You're like, yes, I am gonna become a referee just so I can get myself on TV. And then finally at the Australian Open Sunday with the leader at the time, you got yourself on TV.
I must say, I do remember that dot point on the level two slides.
So,
and I'm just disappointed it took so long.
And there you have it, folks. Finally showing his true colours.
Well, you set that one up on a tee for me. I thought I hit it.
We need to get into that ruling, but before then, and your just general experience, before then, we'll quickly go through the answer to the GRQ OTW for 105, which I had to do on my lonesome, and I didn't even get give Fraser the opportunity to come up with a question, and I bet he would have come up with a doozy. But this one was... easily as tough, I believe. GRQ OTW 105. A player is searching for their tee shot and then finds a ball in the rough that he knows is a ball hit from the teeing area. Their 3-minute search time then expires. He then finds another ball and he knows this is also a ball he hit from the teeing area. The problem is he doesn't know which ball was the original and which ball is the provisional ball. What is the ruling? What do you make of that, Stuart?
So when you say a ball hit from the teeing area, obviously two balls were hit from the teeing area. One was the original ball and one was a provisional ball. I think the fact that after 3 minutes, a ball, which we know for certain has been hit from the teeing area, the fact that a ball has been found within the 3 minutes, I think what happens after that is irrelevant. And I think then a decision needs to be made after that 3 minutes. We know that ball has been hit from the teeing area. We can't identify or distinguish whether it's the original or provisional. I think you've just got to work out. Sorry, you've got to say, well, that's clearly our ball in play. However, because you can't definitively say it was the original, you've got to consider it to be the provisional and you'll be hitting your fourth shot with that ball.
Yeah, really interesting one. I probably didn't know the answer when I asked it, and I probably still don't know the answer. But going off what I've seen in the past, what you're saying is how I see it as well. The ball that you found within the 3 minutes, you have to work out whether that is one of your balls or not. And if you work out that it is one of the ones you hit, but you can't work out which one it is, whether it's the first one or the second one, then working out through the rules and what I've seen, you just work out that this is okay, this is the provisional ball, and you must play that as the provisional ball. I mean, you found a ball that you know is yours. You found it within the 3 minutes. you just can't determine whether it's the original or the provisional. I can't see how you have to go back to the tee and play your fifth.
No.
Yeah, that would be, in my mind, that would be a bit too harsh.
Agreed. We know 18.3 specifically says if you find two balls,
yeah,
and you can't work out which is which, then the rule is very clear on that. And in this particular case, it's not so clear, but I can't see any other way around what we had just discussed. The fact that is, you know, you've hit it from the teeing area. You know it's one of them. You just don't know which one. And I think you have to pay a price for that.
Yeah.
Because you can't tell that it's your original ball or not.
Yeah.
If you didn't find any, of course, then your provisional ball's now the ball in play, but you need to go and find it. And then we're going to have the discussion whether you get a separate 3 minute search time for it, or in fact, if it's tied in with the original search,
yeah,
depending on the proximity to the original.
It's really important that we understand that it's within that 3 minutes that you need to find, you know, your original or your provisional. Any facts after the 3 minutes really don't help us out at all, really. So you found a ball, you need to work out whether it's the original or provisional. If you don't within the 3 minutes, it defaults as your provisional and play on from there.
Digress quickly, a ruling last week, the week before at Cathedral with a well-known player, now retired, now media person, and ball search. Fortunately for him, he had about 50 people trying to help him find this ball. I was timing only because I happened to be there. And I said, you've got 30 seconds left. And then I've gone, it was like 3 minutes and 4 seconds. And I've gone, that's time. The player was like 5 minutes. So I said, that's time. He goes, yeah, okay. I swear, no more than 5 seconds later, one of the spectators goes, oh, I found one here. So, of course, he walks up and goes, yeah, that's it. And he looks at me, he goes, no good. So I said, no. I said, sorry. I said, no, no good, sorry. Anyway, just the way it goes. Three minutes is 3 minutes.
Yeah, that's the way it is.
It's not 3 minutes and 10 seconds.
No, that's right. It's not 3 minutes, but if it's your mate, it's only 2 minutes 59.
Well, depending on who you play with, it could be 5 or 6.
Yeah, well, that's why they brought it down from 5, because 5 used to be 10. Now 3 is 5. So,
but I've seen a discussion recently about, you know, who's responsible for time. There's really no definitive, you know, player X is responsible, the market is responsible, the player is responsible. There's nothing in the rules that says there is someone held accountable or responsible for timing that search.
It depends if it's your friend or, you know, they're trying to beat you.
But it's interesting, though, because, you know, that time is just one of those facts you need to establish.
It should be the player. It's on the player. And, you know, the European Tour are really good at this. The first thing that they'll do when they walk into the area, who's timing?
Right.
And if no one is timing, they almost fine them.
Oh.
Yeah, like they write a letter to them saying this is not good enough.
Yeah, that's
someone needs to have a time on this ball search.
Yeah, that's good. So there's nothing in the rules that would say that, but a tour obviously can say, no, this is one of their rules.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I like it. Yeah, I like it. Who's timing
it? It's behaviour expected of their players, and they expect it of every player, not just. And so, if a player doesn't start it, another player should.
Yeah, no, I like it a lot. Because I said, there's nothing in the rules that says X must have time. So, I think that's a fantastic idea. And you're right, it sort of falls under that umbrella of conduct.
Yeah.
Playing within the spirit of the game, the integrity of the game. So, that's really good to hear.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
European Tour are fantastic with that kind. I mean, they're really good at those kind of things with their relationship with their players and making sure that the players know basic rules as well. You know, if Jerry Maguire calls a referee over for a cart path rule 3 weeks in a row, then that person has to front up at a rules exam. You know, because they obviously don't know the basic of a basic cart path.
For that, don't you think sometimes the players want immunity? So they can't get it wrong? Because there's a referee
possibly
providing their actions?
If it's maybe a really basic one.
Sure.
You know, if it's a difficult one where you're trying to work out whether you do actually have interference or you're just bludging it a bit, we can see that. But if it's just a basic
ball in a car path,
or you have got your foot on it and you just want to drop it out and say and hit the same club in the same shot, blah, blah, blah.
Sure, yeah.
If it's one where I'm dropping out there, but can I now change my club?
Mm.
Okay, that is easy for us, but for them maybe, you know, and so mark, their marker going, hang on, you were going to hit edge, now you're in 3 wood.
Right, yeah.
Different situation.
Yes.
So we've got a few clubland stories today, we've also got Stuart's experience. If you haven't read his blog, it's on Golf Rules Questions Facebook. It's also on the web page after we got the website sorted. So you can go and read it. It's a fantastic read, but we will get podcast thoughts and feelings a little bit as well after these clubland stories. And we're also going to hopefully start, if we have the time, a new little segment where we try and go a little bit more advanced and find discussions from, we had Fraser Nicol on the show last week for 105. He runs a fantastic Facebook community for those people who want to or are learning, are in the process of learning the rules of golf, not just for any average golfer who just wants to read these discussions and not contribute, but those that are actually sitting exams. He has a fantastic community called the Golf Rules Samaritan, TGRS, on Facebook. We're going to grab a few discussion points on some quirky rules and also off the USGA rules site. So we've got a couple today, but we'll next time we're on, we'll do a lot more. But we'll get through our clubland stories, podcast experience of the AO, and then finish with a few quirky ones from the TGRS. So this one's from Mr. Roberts. Firstly, may I say, Blakey, it was you who started the Mr. Roberts bit, because there are too many Davids. There are certainly too many Davids in golf. I will attest to that, Mr. Roberts. Now, the question issue. Fifth hole at Hilltop, 320-metre par 4 with water all down the left side for 250 metres. Red penalty area pegs about 3 to 4 metres from the edge of the water and fairly steep bank from edge of fairway to the water. Player A hits tee shot, which came to rest in the red penalty area but not in the water. I'm not sure of this exactly, but for this question, let's say the ball entered the penalty area about 10 metres the T side of where it came to rest.
Okay.
Player A cannot get a stance to hit up the fairway toward the hole, but can try to hit out straight up the bank 90 degrees to the fairway. Player A makes a stroke, but alas, grass catches club head, ball moves up the bank, but does not get out of the penalty area and rolls back into the water. I'm thinking this is a 17.2.
Mm.
Player A then has to take relief, which he does by lateral relief by dropping a ball into the play on the exact line on which he tried to hit the ball out of the penalty area with his second shot. That is straight up the bank line. Sounds like a line of flight. One shot penalty, and then he plays his fourth up the fairway. In the clubhouse later, well after player A has gone home, I get called over to a group of players enjoying post-game refreshments. Two of these players were in the group with player A and were discussing this incident with another player who called me over for an opinion. The player who was not in the playing group thought that player A should have gone back to the point of entry where his tee shot crossed into the penalty area to take the relief drop. I checked rule 17.2A and the associated diagram, fantastic diagram in the rules of golf, which shows the ball in penalty area being hit in the direction of the hole, and I agreed that player A should have gone back to point of entry and not dropped straight up the bank. Your thoughts, please. Nothing, what came of this? Nothing really resolved because player A had gone home, his card had was signed and in the system. I think a few of us learned something. One of those, hopefully this wasn't club championship. Otherwise, because they weren't aware of the correct procedure, it would normally just be add the penalty on before the competition is closed, which would be two shots for playing from a wrong place. We actually covered this one.
kind of covered this one with Colin's last question in the last Clubland October, where someone tried to take a line of flight for an unplayable. And that's basically what's gone on here. So 17.2, which podcast is about to go through, and just give us the idea of the reasoning behind 17.2. But basically what happened was player A dropped in a wrong place for a one-shot penalty, played from a wrong place. So he's got the one-shot penalty for 17, rule 17, taking relief from the penalty area. And then he's got the two-shot penalty for playing from a wrong place. 10 metres, in my mind, as the committee, is not a serious breach. So I wouldn't DQ him, but he definitely should get the two-shot penalty. Stuart, your thoughts on 17.2?
Yeah, I can't add anything more than what you just said.
Absolutely you can.
Well, I know, everything you just said, I would have said.
What's the idea of
17.2? Is you never, if your ball's lying in a red penalty area and you attempt, to play it and make multiple strokes at it, but you can't get out, you never give up that point of entry as an option available to you to get out of that penalty area. So if your ball's lying in a penalty area and you take 10 shots out of frustration to try to get out, and you're now 20, 30, 50 metres further towards the hole, but now you're in a worse spot, you still have the option to take penalty relief out of that penalty area at the point where your ball last crossed into that penalty area. You never surrender that option, ever. That's what 17.2 is all about. But if your ball's lying in a penalty area and you make a stroke and your ball remains in that penalty area or goes into another one, you have all the normal penalty area relief options. So in this particular case, the fact that we've had that second shot to try to get up the bank and it wasn't successful is irrelevant. You know, you still, when the shot counts, you've got to come back to where it entered if you want to get out of that penalty area and take relief.
Okay.
That's what 17.2 is all about.
A advisor of ours told us that we have to disagree a bit more to make it a little bit more enjoyable to listen to. So this is the first time that I'm going to disagree with you.
Good.
And it's not because you're wrong. It's that you're not quite right.
Okay.
The easiest way to do this is read the heading. This is what our friend Jeff would tell us. When ball played from penalty area comes to rest in same or another penalty area, you still have all the options that 17.1 provided you. Stuart said that. But they could slightly change if the ball had gone out and come back in. Okay?
Yep. Would you believe my GRQOTW for this week may or may not be related to this rule?
Good.
Can you believe that?
So, in player A's case, Mr. Roberts said the ball did not get the penalty area. So, he's still got the option of going back to the tee for a one-shot penalty. He's still got the option of lateral relief from where the ball last crossed into the penalty area, which was 10 metres from where the ball ended up, tee side. He's still got line of play. No,
back on the line.
Back on the line, thank you. Back on the line from that where the ball last crossed with the flag.
But you can't drop it in the same penalty area.
But you can't drop in the same one. You can drop in a different one or in a bunker or in a putting green.
Or in a
wrong green. So you've got those three and that's it. You can drop it within a club length of where you last played it from.
Yep.
In the penalty area. It's like one of the only times you can drop it in the same penalty area. Okay, so just adding on that if the ball does come out and go back in, now you've got a new last place crossed into the penalty area, which changes your back on the line and changes your lateral relief.
Sure does.
But you still have all the options of the one-shot penalty dropping outside the penalty area or teeing it up if the tee up was one of your last shots or was your last shot. So played from the wrong place.
Definitely.
What's the rule for playing from the wrong place?
14.7, you mean?
14.7.
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
Number 14.7, yep.
Excellent. So that one, does that any more to add? No, I actually, we played golf the other day at Freeway, which is in Camberwell Golf Club, Freeway, right beside Q, right beside the works for the northeast tunnel. And I played pretty well, but my friend didn't play so good, and he hit one in the penalty area, and it was sort of dog leg, and he hit it in the right hand side trees in here. And I go, one of your options, take lateral leaf. And I said, you could take back on the line, kind of laughing. And he goes, and he starts measuring the line of flight. Mm. Now, he wouldn't have got away with it, and he would have thought about it and gone, I can't do that. But he said, just this way. And I go, no, it's not line of flight, it's back on the line, which would have been on the other side of the trees. But trust me, he wouldn't have got away with it. He would have thought, what am I doing? But he did think about that at the start, and then I had to correct him.
Is that what he said? That's why I only play with Blakey once a year.
Yeah, that's right. Right, so we've finished with Mr. Roberts' first one. He does have another showing. Colin, back again. And he's gone sigh. Probably because he knows it's just Mr. Roberts and Colin that contribute the most. Playing the par three second at Waimate, we'll know every hole at Waimate soon. Colin tees off in a group of five. Surrounding the green are ornamental conifers that have been trimmed from the ground up to about waist height, looking similar to Christmas trees in a semicircle about 5 or 6 metres apart. Upon reaching the green, Colin and his mates can't seem to find the ball, thinking it could have bounced up into the tree, as these trees do catch a few balls with a hard bounce. Colin discovers his ball has lodged itself between a piece of loose bark and the trunk of the tree a few inches up. Colin takes an unplayable 2 club lengths from where the ball was lodged. As the branches are still quite spread out at about waist height, Colin puts his next shot hunched over as he can't stand upright and eventually puts out for 5. Just asking a question, was this the right action to take under the tree, or should he have dropped the ball 2 club lengths away from the branches so he would have had a better stance? Did he have the correct number of penalty shots? Was he playing as unplayable from the wrong spot? What do you think, podcast?
Oh, you heard me laughing about the second option, about taking the branches into consideration. Hang on, guys, if I just come a bit further out here, then I'll take my 2 club lengths. We know there's 3 options for an unplayable in the general area. One that you don't need to know the location of the ball, the other two you do, and the other two are based on, which includes lateral, are based on the spot of the ball, not the reason why it's unplayable, including tree branches. So yeah, so I think that player has proceeded correctly.
Yeah, it says Colin takes an unplayable 2 club lengths from where the ball was lodged. So the only thing, there's 2 things to say about that.
Yeah.
A, that it wasn't nearer the hole, and B, that it was from the spot directly below where the ball was. But if you think about it, if you do measure your club length like that, then you're definitely going to be inside the 2 club lengths.
Yeah, like flat on the ground.
Yeah, flat on the ground is definitely going to be wider, longer than, but it is from the spot directly below where the ball is and no nearer the hole.
Yeah.
Colin, sounds like you've done it correctly. It was a 1-shot penalty, and you don't get the nicest point, or that's probably under the nearest point, but you don't get, you take your 1-shot penalty unplayable, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you get to drop in a nice spot. So you've, it sounds like you've done it correctly.
And of course, there's no guarantee that when you take an unplayable, that your ball becomes playable.
Yeah, it could have taken another hard bounce back up into the tree.
Exactly the same spot.
Being within the 2 club lengths,
yeah,
and you'd have to either play it or take another unplayable.
And another comment I'll make is the fact that you can take multiple unplayables.
Yes.
So you take your lateral. Yeah, you take your lateral 2 club lengths, not good enough, take another 2 club lengths.
Correct.
At another penalty stroke.
Can you, if you take an unplayable lateral and then it's in a crappy position, can you then take back on the line, and where do you take that back on the line from?
where the ball was near.
Right. So where the ball was come to rest,
because flag pick.
Yeah. Right. And then once you drop it back on the line, can you now take another lateral?
Yes. Yeah, you can just keep going. I don't know why you would, but you can keep going.
And
I was
then,
going to throw another one at you.
And then once you've taken, so you've gone lateral, back on the line, lateral
again. Yeah.
Can you go back to the tee?
If that was where your last physical stroke was made, yes.
And that would just cost you one more shot.
Of course.
So you got one, two, three, you'll be back.
So your stroke and distance relates to the last previous place. Where you actually made your last physical shot.
And that's under rule.
Oh, 19.2 something.
Right. 19.1,
19.2. See, 19.21, no guaranteed ball will be playable after taking a relief.
But the actual rule is 19.
Yeah, sorry, 19 is unplayable. 19.2 is...
Is it 19.A or is it 19.2A?
The options?
Yeah.
So there's 19.1, 2 and 3, I think, because 3 is bunker, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, okay.
19.3 is bunker.
So 19.1 just tells us what an unplayable ball is.
Correct. 19.2, A, B and C are your three options here. Stroke and distance back on the line lateral. And then 19.3 is bunker because, of course, you have that additional... available
for a two-shot penalty, the only two-shot penalty in match play.
It doesn't give you a loss of holders.
Right, Mr. Roberts, back again.
Oh, geez.
Firstly, this will probably be the last story from me for 2023, so happy Christmas away from all golf rules, and we look forward to, and he's written a poem for us. Actually, we'll leave the poem right to the end. We'll get to the questions first. Hilltop, Wednesday, 22nd of November. Woman playing a stableford event. This is a good one, actually. Course superintendent with boom spray machine spraying fairways. At either end of the boom spray, a dash of blue foam is expelled onto the fairways about every 10 metres. The foam, which dissipates in a couple of hours, is actually a guide for the boom spray operator, so he knows the width extent of what has been sprayed and can keep spray lines straight with minimal overlap. Mary hits great drive down the down the 10th hole. It's a par 5. Mary and her playing group proceed down the fairway, and alas, they cannot see Mary's ball anywhere. But after 2 minutes, less than three, a member of the group sees a ball in one of the bits of spray foam. Mary walks over, places a tee immediately behind the ball, then touches and rotates the ball to find her marking and states, "This is my ball."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was all fine.
All rich,
Judy, one of the playing group, laughs and says, "I wonder if we can say foam is water-like, what we used to call casual water and temporary water now, and you get a free drop." Pam, the other member of the group, also laughing, says, "I'd love to watch you play it." What was resolved, Mary waves to a player on the parallel fairway and beckons her over to seek her opinion. After discussion of all involved, they decide the foam on the fairway is abnormal course condition, and Mary can take relief without penalty and wipe any foam from her ball. Was the decision correct? Could the foam be defined as a loose impediment and brushed away? The chances of this ever happening again would be greater than getting a hole-in-one. The story became the highlight of the day in the clubhouse gathering later. There is always a first time for something around golf. What do you think?
Without naming it correctly, would it be, you know, movable obstruction, loose impediment, something, dew, frost, water, something? Would you say propelled air? Without naming it correctly, I have no issues with that person taking relief.
Yeah.
From that situation.
Yeah. It's artificial. We agree with that.
Yeah.
And artificial water.
Something. Yeah.
Artificial water, I wouldn't say is temporary water. I'd actually say that that's an obstruction.
It's almost man-made.
Yeah.
Almost. With the foam in it.
Well, it is. It is. It got there by someone spraying.
Yeah, like propelled air and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, like manufactured ice.
Yeah.
So I would say that that's an obstruction. Whether it's a movable obstruction or an immovable obstruction.
I reckon if you tried to move it, you'd break it apart, which means it's immovable. Because you've damaged it.
What happens if it's attached to your ball?
Well, you're allowed to clean it with taking relief.
Relief from what?
The very thing.
Because if it's an immovable obstruction,
right?
Are you breaking it when you clean it?
No, because you're allowed to clean your ball when you're taking relief.
Well, not necessarily. From a movable obstruction, you're supposed to move the
Right. Yeah, sure.
And not the ball.
I think in this case, you would make it immovable because, as I said, if you try to move it, you're going to damage it.
But if it's stuck to your ball.
Okay, you take the ball off, there's still some on the ground.
What about the stuff that's on your foot?
You definitely clean that off.
Right.
Yeah.
And you've now broken the immovable structure.
You have, but you're entitled to relief from it. It's almost like your ball's on that immovable structure. You're entitled to free relief.
Well, the immovable obstruction is on your ball.
And on the ground still.
I.
That's what I'm saying, wording it and coming up with the precise technical how you would describe it. I think what's more important is I don't think anyone would have any issues with
that. No, I don't think so either. I think they've correctly taken relief from this abnormal course condition. It just gets me whether it's movable or immovable obstruction.
Well, you think it's very movable because you almost blow it away.
Actually, potentially. I think it is movable. And then if it is movable, then you don't get to clean your ball unless your ball gets moved.
Right. Mm.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I said,
you pick the foam away, you're not going to be penalised if your ball moves.
Yeah.
But you don't, if the ball doesn't move, you don't get to pick your ball up.
This is what I say about any movable obstruction. Any obstruction that cannot be moved without unreasonable effort, so it doesn't qualify, or without damaging the obstruction. Well, and I think you're damaging it.
You are.
Because you're pulling it apart. That's why I said movable. And that's why I think that's fine.
That's why you said immovable.
That's why I reckon it's immovable, because you're damaging it.
Well, with that in mind, I would say
cannot be moved without unreasonable effort or without damaging it. You're damaging it. Your ball's sitting on top of this immovable obstruction. That's why I think you're entitled to relief.
That's why I think it's a movable obstruction.
Okay.
Does it say anywhere that you're not allowed to damage a movable obstruction?
Does it say anywhere you're not allowed to damage a movable? Probably not.
Because if it's a scorecard, you can rip it out.
Yeah, no, you sure can. But what I'm saying is, by definition, any obstruction that, you know, cannot be moved without damaging it is immovable. And I'm saying if you start to move it, you're damaging it. You're pulling it apart, breaking it into pieces. Anyway, we should disagree more.
Without damaging the obstruction.
That's what the fans want.
That's right. Cannot be moved without reasonable effort.
Or without damaging it. And you are damaging it by moving.
But then it is going to dissipate in 2 hours, so it's damaging itself.
It is. That's none of our concern.
If you look at it this way, if it dissipates,
yes,
and that is technically... It cannot be considered damaging,
right?
Because that is the life cycle of the foam. The life cycle of the foam is that it disappears.
Okay, I mean,
that's not damaging.
I'm not pounding my fist on the table like this one. I'm not.
I am.
No, that's fine.
I don't think it's damaging to.
I think the committee at that club would make a pretty reasonable decision and everyone would be okay with it.
Well, I think the committee are not going to call it an immovable or a
movable. No, they would say, no, you're fine.
They're just going to call it an abnormal course.
Yeah, you're fine. Just take it.
Similar to temporary water, but temporary water. Does temporary water say that it's natural?
Temporary is just a temporary accumulation of water. And then it's not normally there, like in Victoria last week. Any temporary accumulation of water on the surface of the ground?
Yeah, I guess because it could come out of your hose when you're irrigating. Yeah, it does say, or irrigation, or an overflow from the body of water.
Mm.
But this, because this has a specific type of chemical in it.
Yeah, that's why I think it's an obstruction. It's artificial objects.
Yeah, I agree with that.
We just are not sure whether it's movable or immovable. Which, of course, are two different rules. One's 15.2, one's 16.1. There's two different ways you tackle.
It comes down to the committee.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to move on.
I know they're going to be right.
I'm saying movable. You're saying immovable.
But I'm not panning off your
side. But at the same time, I say movable, but I agree that the relief was in that situation was okay.
You're okay with it.
Which makes my sort of thought process wrong, but that's right. Right, next one from Chip.
While playing a par three island green where the entrance to the green was on the back, a player hit her ball and rolled off the back of the green. Not having played this course, she was not sure if it was wet, aka in a red penalty area, or in the rough. She immediately walked over to the drop zone about 20 yards closer, dropped a ball, called a provisional, and hit on. Is that allowed if she crossed the red stake into the water? The ball ended up caught in the rough and the provisional was picked up. This happened at Lone Tree Golf Course in Arizona. Wow. If she didn't know that over the back was a red stake penalty area, then that's okay to play a provisional ball, but it's not okay to go to the drop zone
and call it a provisional
ball. And now the drop zone is there. I want to see how they mark it
as an option.
As an option if you hit your ball in the penalty area.
So she's almost admitting, well, it's obviously in there.
Yeah.
Or it's, I'll play this provisionally. If it is in there, I don't need to come back to the drop zone.
I'll play this provisionally.
Because if we go down there and it's definitely in, well, I've already proceeded correctly. I don't have to go back.
Yeah. Yeah, so she should have taken the one that she dropped. The one that she dropped was the ball in play as soon as she hit it.
Yeah. And they say it's the model local rule in place that allows you to have provisional.
B3 or whatever.
Sure, and your ball might be in a penalty area.
So,
which I know you love.
So, yeah, so Chip, if she drops the ball in the dropping zone, unless there's local rules that we don't know about, she cannot call that ball a provisional ball. It's 20 yards closer to the green. It's the that drop zone would be an option under 17. That you had hit your ball in the, you knew you'd hit the ball in the penalty area.
It's unfortunate if there's rough there because, you know, we know you can only hit a provisional if your ball might be lost outside a penalty area. And in this particular case, this happened at Australian Open at the Lakes, and the guys were on the tee going, oh, so you hit a provisional. Well, your ball's either in the penalty area or it's not. And if it's not, you'll find it.
Yes.
So you can't hit a provisional.
In this case, but even in this case where if it was fairway into penalty area, because she didn't know the hole.
Yes. Oh yeah, that's but then, it's then surrounded again, by water though.
Island green.
Surrounded by
she'd never maybe she hadn't looked up and seen that the hole maybe was in a tree.
No, it's a penalty area.
Yeah, but it could be just water, and then over the back was she's thinking, how does the mower get on there?
There's what?
Mower.
Well, we know there's a walkway in the back.
Lawnmower.
Yeah.
How do you say?
Well, lawnmower. We know there's a walkway in the back. You have to, you know, catch a boat to get onto the green, but it's surrounded by water. We know there's a penalty area. We just probably don't know what colour it is.
Like, I'm not going to debate her reasoning for why she thought it wasn't a penalty area.
Yeah.
You are, if you're not sure and you think that it's lost outside, I mean, she could have thought that there was rough before the penalty area, and it could have been 6 inches high, depending on what other parts of the course, played sort of similar to that. But the fact is, she did not play the provisional correctly by playing from the last place, previous place played. She went to the drop zone. The drop zone would be
an option.
An option under Rule 17. So that is the ball in play. As she picked up her ball in the rough, that was the ball in play, so it's going to be another shot penalty. She picked up the provisional. That's the ball in play.
Yeah.
So it's another shot penalty, and then she's played a wrong ball.
And not corrected it.
So DQ. Good question, Chip. Love that. Right, so that's all club level, club land.
You told me this years ago, not that we've known each other that long, but you told me this years ago, two of the most commonly misunderstood rules, both start with P.
Yeah.
And when you combine the two of them, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. And another one starts with UP, unplayable.
But provisional and penalty areas.
Yeah.
Combine those two, people go bananas with just confusion and stuff.
I'd love to make them simpler if there was a way, but I just don't see a way that doesn't also take away, continue the challenge of the game of golf. I mean, if you want to make it easy, you just go, okay, you've
You can hit a provisional if you
anytime.
Drop your ball in the fairway. That's the easiest.
And the provisional will be, and you can play it anytime. Like you can choose it as your ball when you're gone.
Yes.
And not even worry about.
That would take out a lot of.
Oh, there's my unplayable. So there's my original. It's unplayable. I forget it. I'll just go and play
correct.
Original. Correct. That sort of stuff.
Correct.
Which we know you can't do, but that would simplify things a lot.
Exactly right.
Happened at Sandbelt last week, that particular incident. Anyway, digress.
Well, it's now your turn to shine.
I'll just tell you about this ruling with, I applauded the player.
Right.
So I'm actually driving in for a quick lunch break and I come to the lead group, the last two players who after round three were one at 15, one at 11, and then daylight to third. And they're coming out of these bushes and I'm getting waved down to give them a drive back to the tee. I said, oh, okay. I said, and as we're driving back to the tee, he goes, I'll just slow down, I'll pick up this ball here. I go, what's that ball? He says, my provisional. And I basically almost slammed on the brakes. Hang on just a second. Hang on. What can you just describe to him what's happened? He said, I found my original. I wanted to take an unplayable. My best option for an unplayable was stroke and distance. I said, okay, thank you. Continue driving back to the tee. We picked up his provisional. I said, thank you for not playing the provisional. He goes, well, it pays to every now and again read the rules, he said to me. And I said, well done for not playing the provisional ball as an option for stroke and distance for your unplayable.
Which round was that?
Fourth round.
At
Royal Melbourne East. Wow. Fifth hole. Just over the road, fifth hole. Drove back to the corner to the tee. And he said to me, he said, oh, well, every now and again I open up the rule book. And he's the guy who won with a hole in one on the 16th hole.
Oh, wow.
To get back into the lead. Remember, I phoned you.
Oh, wow. Oh, so, yeah. Oh, wow.
Mm. So, he had a double. He had a double on that hole.
Oh, my God.
It was six over through 13 holes.
Wow.
And now not in the lead.
Wow.
Yeah. Birdie's 15 has a hole in one on 16 to retake
it. Did you see the hole in one?
I was standing behind the tee and heard the commotion and saw him throw the club.
Yeah, right.
And not in disgust.
No, no.
He's just thrown it back to the caddy so that then, you know, enjoy, absolute joy. And I go, wait, what?
Yeah.
And I took a video of him. I've got it here on my phone. I took a video of him retrieving the ball out of the hole, which I'd like to think went viral, but it did.
Yeah, well, you put your camera there and you're like, going up there. Hi, we're going up. Hold on. Because I know, and then you sent it in Channel 9, didn't you?
I didn't do that. But I did take that video.
So you've had a lot of.
Pretty happy about it.
You've had a lot of experiences over the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, done quite a few events.
Everyone wants to know about the Australian Open, not necessarily the time that you made sure to get your face on TV, but, you know, what was this? That was your first Australian Open?
It was. You know, the funny thing about that camera, I'd never see it.
Of course.
Because one, there was 500 people. And it must have been this little tiny handheld thing.
Right.
And you know what? You know what every person is doing around that ball? They've got their phone out. So everyone was holding something. And this guy just happened to be holding something a little bit bigger. But not as if it was a massive tripod, you know, nothing. It's just this tiny little thing. So I didn't even know the camera was there. And of course, by that time I was told to, you need to find out if this ball's in bounds or not. I wasn't caring about people or cameras or anything. But back to the experience. It was a great experience. Obviously, because of the crowds, gallery ropes, heaps of volunteers on every hole. And I make a point of saying hello to those volunteers and what's your job today? And some are quite, one in particular was pretty military about, very, very strict. And you go through the lakes under the tunnel to the second hole. And the players were, as soon as they got out, you know, course, as soon as they get out of the tunnel, they're turning right, go up the path behind the tee to get to the second tee. And I just happened to be sitting by this marshal who's up the path, and he's going to the players and going, whoa, no, stop, no, you need to come up here. And I said, mate, let him go, they're fine. No, I've been told the players have got to walk up to this path and then go to the tee. I said, don't worry about it. He was really taking his job a little bit too. The caddies and the players couldn't look here less than they're going up that path. They knew the tee was right there and they were just going to walk up this dirt track, turn left, and they were there. And I reckon every single point of crew did that. Anyway, back to that. Lots of volunteers, lots of gallery, lots of ropes. But, you know, I wrote this in the report. Really quickly, I realised it was just a tournament. So we did all the usual stuff. And we had our timing sheet and the tee sheet and the local rules. And we had our radio and just monitor pace of play. And it was just really another tournament. Now, it got bigger on the weekend when, you know, the crowds were pretty amazing. As in fantastic size crowds, and you felt the buzz and the atmosphere, but really it was just doing what you do, doing what a lot of other guys do and girls, just refereeing. So when I was in that group on Saturday, my first ruling was Lucas Herbert was stuck right behind one of those advertising boards, and the guy goes, oh, what do I do here? I said, well, it's movable. So the volunteer and the caddy lifted it, like, just normal stuff. So it was great. I mean, great atmosphere, great event. Really thrilled I did it. If I don't do another, at least I can say I've done it. I know you've done 20 of them, but not quite. But it was fantastic. It was a great experience. And, you know, there was a lot more referees than I thought there'd be because, of course, the last, what, maybe five, six, seven, eight groups of both tees on the Sunday had a walking referee.
Yeah.
And you had all the rovers as well. There's probably six of those, maybe six to eight. Seeing guys work from the DP World Tour, the European Tour, two referees and some admin staff, that was good. Just to see they did all the stuff the same way. It was good to see them maybe describe something a different way, or it was a great experience. And as I said, thank you for your kind words about the report. I really enjoyed writing that. It was nice to see so many people have read it and written some comments. Because, yeah, that was the experience. It was terrific. It was
really good. Some thought that was a bit too long, thought it was a bit like a novel and they weren't going to read it.
That's their choice.
But, you know, another novel that they could read was Trading in a Nutshell. can help you with trading. And it's written by Stuart McPhee.
That's their choice.
Fourth edition.
Thank you. If they don't want to read it, don't read it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was thinking.
Just, your mother said, can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. If you click on it and see 2,000 words, okay, go and read something else.
There's some good pictures there, though.
Hmm?
There's some good pictures there. I think you got in about four or five of them.
One of them, someone said, stand there at your first Australian Open. And I wasn't going to stand there. Another referee said, oh, okay.
So I've got a couple of questions. What day did you get up there?
What
day?
Wednesday.
You got up there Wednesday. The tournament started on Thursday. When did you go and see the lakes? When did you have your little referee drive around to the lakes?
The next morning.
The day of starting.
Correct.
Wow.
So I was there early. I went out before play even started. So I remember first hole, I'm on 2, 3, 4, 8. I've gone out there and I actually drove all the four holes. Now, I had played it once, so I was sort of familiar with the course, okay. But pardon me. But yeah, just that morning.
And then for the Australian, which was played on the Saturday, Sunday, apparently.
It was played all 4 days, but I was only there.
Yeah, you
Saturday, were, Sunday.
But it was the only course being played on Saturday, Sunday.
Correct, sorry, yeah.
When did you go and take a look at?
Wednesday, because we were there for the meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when did you work out where the boundary stakes were for hole 7?
Not early enough. Not early enough. Yeah.
So,
but you know, I wrote an article about this, unrelated to this, about the collaborative effort for refereeing. You know, someone said to me, I reckon they're spot on. 90% of our rulings are all the same.
Yeah.
Car path, temporary water, GUR, whatever it might be.
Out of bounds.
It's every now and again, it's one of the unplayable, but common. It's a collaborative effort, though. So, you know, for that ruling, I spoke to two people. I wasn't going to do it on my own because it was important. So it was that straight away, that collaborative effort of jumping on the radios, talking to two people. And I think, and a few of the guys in the PGA have said this, that if there's 1% of doubt, just get on the damn radio, right? It takes 10 seconds to get it right, to get the consistency. Just jump on the radio. And I used to think it was almost an embarrassment to get on the radio. You talk about the guy that played 3 weeks in a row taking relief from a car path. And the tour dragged him in and said, mate, you've got to learn this rule. Imagine if you're jumping on the radio all the time about the same thing all the time. Everyone else is going to go, does he know the rules? When did he do his level two course? Or doing his waiver course, you know? So there's that.
Unfortunately, that's the stigma
of your don't know the rules, so why are you even here? But as I've always said, the referee is your friend. I've asked about from some pretty simple rulings just so I make sure, and it gives you a bit of time as well.
Then you can have just an absolute brain fade.
Yeah.
Where if you were asked 5 minutes ago, you would have known.
Yeah.
If you're asked the next day, you would know. And for some reason, you just weren't thinking clearly.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, like a sugar. It could be just something stupid, but you just jump on the radio and someone else who is thinking clearly knows the rule. Yeah, it's this. Oh, yeah, of course it is. Bang. Right rulings given. Consistency is achieved. Yeah, so as I said, it's a very collaborative effort, refereeing. And I think good referees should jump on the radio a lot. And in fact, again, one of the PGA guys said to me, who did maybe the Irish Open this year, he's come back and thought, we don't talk enough on the radio.
No.
We're not talking to each other enough.
No.
Like towards the end of a tournament, we're entertaining each other with commentary about how the finish is happening. He said, we don't talk enough during the day about stuff that's going on. There should be more of it.
I guess there's only about three of you doing rules on your tour, though.
Yeah, depending on the event. I mean, there'll be more at the
pretty short start.
Yeah, there'll be more at the Vic Open, typically four.
Yeah.
And one of them is the tournament director.
Typically four.
Yeah.
That's pretty small.
And one of them is the tournament director.
Yeah.
Is doing other things outside the ropes as well, as well as being a referee. But he was saying, we don't talk enough on the radio.
Yeah.
There should be more of it. And that's, you know, we talked about that post about what have you learned this year. To me, one of the things I've learned is the difference between technical knowledge and practical application on a golf course.
Yeah.
I said this to your friend and our friend Marcella just not so long ago, that when you read all those Facebook posts or quizzes, every piece of information you need to make an answer, to give an answer, is presented to you. And the art of refereeing is you actually need to complete the question first before you actually work out the answer.
Yeah.
And sometimes the rules can be really quite straightforward. It's establishing the facts, but it's a challenge. That's really a difficulty.
You've got to work out the question. What's the question before?
Hasn't even been completed.
Yeah.
You've actually got to finish writing the question when you get there. And that's the art of refereeing.
Yeah.
And any question given to you, everything you need to answer it is there.
Yeah.
When you're refereeing for real, that's not necessarily the case.
Refereeing for real, you've got to ask the question and then find the answer.
Some of the questions have been asked by the player. Yeah. You've actually got to finish writing it. And then you get to the answer.
By asking questions to find the facts that determine what the actual question is.
One of them could be, what areas of course is the ball line?
That's pretty good.
And, you know, every question you read has that.
Yeah.
Ball's line, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so that can be the other refereeing. Great experience. I'm definitely a better referee because of it.
Yeah.
Just this much, but better.
And you did the Sandbell Invitational, which was amazing.
I did Cathedral 2 days later.
Cathedral was easy because it was good weather. Sandbell Invitational.
Yeah.
This is Melbourne weather summed up.
Yeah.
We're
in summer.
The first day was thunderstorms.
Overnight that morning. Yeah. And then light rain.
The first day was flooding.
Correct.
At Victoria.
Correct.
And there's not many golf courses that could handle it, but Victoria could handle it. But they did have a massive lake on the 10th hole. That's not normally there. So you had a lot of rollings there.
That's the busiest I've ever been on a golf course.
And then the next day it was 34 degrees. 34 degrees Celsius, so boiling.
90-ish, a bit more than 90. Right. Yeah.
Fair enough. Then players had to deal with heat stroke and all that kind of thing and drinking lots of water.
Yep.
The next day, it was cold, wet, and miserable, right?
At Yarra Yarra. It wasn't that cold, but it was thunderstorms.
Thunderstorm.
Correct.
That was a thunderstorm.
Yeah,
thunderstorm. They had suspension, come back.
Two suspensions
within about an hour and a half.
Yeah, correct.
So we send them out for what, half a hole? And then
no, it wasn't. A bit more than that, but it wasn't long.
Wow.
Yeah, and then had to get them back off again. Yeah. We had one guy, he's a committee procedure thing for you. So we had one guy with the first suspension on the 18th with a 4 foot putt for par.
Yeah.
The other two guys had already finished.
Okay.
For the other two players had already finished.
And they wanted to go.
Which, of course, is his marker as well. So that guy's come in. How long are we going to be for suspension? Oh, it won't be less than an hour.
I want to go home.
And he's gone, I wouldn't mind going home. So, of course, we just arranged that when he had that one putt.
They signed.
He signed.
And then you signed.
Correct. He signed the scorecard. And I sat by the 18th green watching him make that putt on the resumption of play, radioed it through, said he did have a four on that hole.
Sorry, we went through that a little bit too quickly. So what happened was this group, two had already finished, one had a 4 foot putt, bang, the horn goes.
the marker wants to go home because he's finished. And so he signs the scorecard, and then Stuart watched the player make or miss the 4 foot putt, and then signed that he attested for that shot plus the other 70 shots that the player had.
Effectively, yeah. So it's that committee certifying, even though the marker's gone.
We do this, tours do this. I've done this year where guys want to finish that night, say Thursday night, and then they're coming back the next morning. But one guy doesn't want to finish that night. He wants to come back the next morning and finish his round. So the other two play out. This guy comes back, and we attest to his score for that last hole. But yeah,
fantastic. And as a committee, of course, there's no higher authority in that event to certify that score.
Well, technically, it doesn't, the marker is determined by your committee. So Correct. The marker has just been the committee passed that was on the player as the marker
responsibility.
Onto a committee member as the marker.
Correct. Spot
totally on. Right. We're running out of time for 106. So what we're going to do is run through the GRQ OTW 106. We did tease you about the advanced, but I think we'll get those done soon in another podcast. But just running out of time, Stuart is going to give us the GRQ OTW 106, and then we're going to finish up. So, Stuart.
We talked about 17 point something before, didn't we, about ball and penalty area? So, GRQ OTW for 106. Big P has hit his tee shot into the red penalty area, running down the right side of the 14th hole, say at Wombat Hills. After 2 minutes of searching, he finds and identifies his ball. So it's lying in the penalty area. He makes a stroke at the ball and only advances it 3 metres. Frustrated, he makes another stroke at it from inside the penalty area, moving it very little, and then again makes another stroke. Very frustrated, he says he is returning to the teeing area to start the hole again. Despite some significant and strong objections from others in the group, off he goes back to the teeing area, he returns to the teeing area, tees up a ball, and makes a stroke from the teeing area and finishes the hole. There are no players waiting behind to hit. Once he completes play that hole, how many penalty strokes must Big P add to his hole score? His score for that hole. How many penalty strokes must Big P add to his score for that hole?
Okay, I think I've got it. It's like one of the first ones I've actually listened to. But I do have one question.
Good.
He makes another stroke from inside the PA, moving it very little.
Yeah.
It had come to rest before he made another stroke.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
So effectively, he's had a tee shot, gone into the red penalty area, found and identified. He's made a second stroke at it inside the penalty area, stayed inside the penalty area, made a third stroke at it, didn't go anywhere, and made a fourth stroke at it, all within this red penalty area and gone, this is ridiculous. I'm not having a great day. I'm going back to the team starting again.
Well, if you've gotten this far to the GRQ OTW 106, you'll know that we spoke about this right at the start of the episode with one of the Clubland questions, Clubland stories. So you should have this one all well and done.
How many penalty strokes must be PA?
We're not asking for how many strokes. We're just asking for how many penalty strokes.
Correct.
Excellent. Another episode of GRQ, not as long as the one with Fraser, but it's that Fraser one has been really welcomed or really enjoyed by a lot of people. So thank you very much, Fraser Nickel, for giving up your time. We will go into these TGRS discussions and USGA stuff in another episode. But thank you everyone for listening in for 106, and we will be back again, back with you very soon. Thank you, Stuart.
Thanks, Blakey.